The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Good afternoon and welcome to Family First with five-time author and top speaker Randy Rolfe. Your family may be facing a variety of issues that you'd like addressed. No two families in the world face identical problems, but Randy has seen almost all of the difficulties families today face, and she and her expert guests have the answers that you seek. Now, here is your host, Randy Rolfe.
Hello and welcome to Family First. I'm your host, Randy Rolfe, and we're going to be talking about drug-free help for ADHD today with a recognized expert in the field. And first I want to tell you, urge you to go to my website, randyrolfe.com, R-A-N-D-Y-R-O-L-F-E, and there are a couple of free downloads you can get there if you just leave your email. It's an interview I did with another one of Voice America's great hosts, Susan Allison, about my new book, The True Secret to Weight Loss is Energy. And also, if you go to the contact page, you can get chapter 2 of my book, The 7 Secrets of Successful Parents, which gives you the 12 basic needs of children. And we will actually be addressing some of them today with our guest. So more and more kids are being identified as having attention deficits and hyperactivity. And often it's assumed that ADHD is a biological imbalance which requires medication to control. But drugs don't solve the core problem, and the kids end up with habits and labels that may have unwanted consequences for their future. My guest this week on Family First is psychologist Dr. Craig B. Wiener, who specializes in the treatment of children, adolescents, and their families. He's become well known for questioning the growing tendency to make behavior problems into medical disabilities. His groundbreaking work with ADHD shows that the behaviors included in the ADHD diagnosis can become frequent due to reinforcement. And in his new book, Parenting Your Child with ADHD, A No-Nonsense Guide for Nurturing Self-Reliance and Cooperation, he gives parents a powerful new drug-free way to eliminate ADHD behavior by stopping those reinforcements and instead developing the child's self-reliance and cooperation. Dr. Craig B. Wiener is a licensed psychologist based in Worcester, Massachusetts. He obtained his doctorate from the Clark University and is taught in the psychology graduate department at Clark University and in the undergraduate psychology departments at Worcester State University and Anna Maria College. He's now assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Massachusetts Medical School and clinical director of mental health services at Family Health Center of Worcester, where he supervises clinicians, postdoctoral fellows, and predoctoral psychology and social work interns. He's the author of two books specifically for ADHD professionals and medical professionals and educators, and they are called Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder as a Learned Behavior Pattern, A Return to Psychology, I love that title, and Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder as a Learned Behavior Pattern, A Less Medicinal, More Self-Reliant Collaborative Intervention. And he's a frequent presenter on ADHD at national conferences. So I welcome you to Family First, Dr. Wiener. It's a delight to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm excited to be sharing the insights in your book with our listeners. And so I wanted to start out just by asking you how you originally got interested in this issue. You have a doctorate in education, and this is a very interesting and timely field, what attracted you to taking a different look at ADHD?
Well, I did a postdoc specializing in kids, and I noticed that lots of the kids were coming through with the label of minimal brain dysfunction, and later on this became hyperactivity, and these kids were from the get-go being initiated into their lives with the notion that something's wrong with them. But when I working with them, it became apparent that they did these particular behaviors under very particular circumstances and situations, and the behaviors seemed to repeat given the way in which whatever happened when they did the behaviors. So in that sense, the behaviors can get reinforced and increase in frequency depending on how the world responds. So it seemed like a peculiar medical problem that in one sense the youngster does the behavior and then another time actually does a behavior that says, well, they're doing better than their disability. How could that be? How could they do better than what they're unable to do? So these are kids that if they're doing something that has to do with an activity that's they have a history of doing well at and they're comfortable with, or that it's self-initiated rather than expected by others, they may pursue looking into it, reading study guides, maintain their concentration, they're not distractible at all, they achieve very well, their memory for the activity and the organization of their memory for the activities and what the activity is all about was remarkable. So if they were interested in wrestling or Pokemon, then they talk about the characters and what they did and remember, and it was markedly different from anything that they would do if it was schoolwork or something that others expect or in some ways coerce or impose upon them. So the difference in what they did and how they achieved and how they performed was remarkable.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I know I've done a lot of family counseling myself, and I remember an early client, the child was not doing well at all in school, and she asked me, you know, how come he can sit and trace a map, he can tell you where every country in the world is, and yet the teachers say he's disabled. And she was so frustrated. She and her husband were professors, and he was obviously smart, but he wasn't doing well in school. And so this is something that you noticed in families, that it's they may seem like they can't learn in school, but they can learn things they want to learn.
Yeah, so my sense was that if the so-called problem is, they say, well, ADHD won't occur when there's interest. But interest is a statement about psychology. It's not biology. So I said, well, why don't we get a treatment program that increases the child's interest for those kinds of activities and achievements and behaviors that other people value and like. So if you instead of coercing a child into these kinds of responses, let's increase the child's initiative and interest, because when that occurs, the child doesn't show the problematic behaviors.
That makes a lot of sense. Before we talk more about that, let me just ask how many people are affected by this diagnosis of ADHD?
Well, that's a nice question, because in some ways when I started out in 1979, it was well under 5%, 3% type thing, and it's now escalated to 9%, and then with some socioeconomic groups, it's even higher. So it's become, it's the old movie where if you build it, they will come. So what happens is that we start to characterize people's behavior in certain ways, and once it becomes embedded in our social group, then these categorizations and ways of interpreting a child's behavior gets reinforced, and we all start to identify more and more people. Now, it's not the people. People do the behaviors, and they get the label, but it doesn't tell you why they do the behaviors. So these diagnostic labels are only descriptions of what people do, but it doesn't give you the cause. And yet, as a society, more and more we're taking the label to mean a cause. And in our current society, causes are now biological causes. That's the trend we're in. Whatever it relates to, whether it relates to the fact that we have a lot more drugs to treat things, or that people do a lot more research in terms of brain biology. And what I did was I looked at why do we accept these medical causations when the research can be interpreted in different ways? It's not to deny this medical research, but it's to say, let's look at the research and say, how can we reinterpret it and still have a notion that psychology is involved with anything we do?
Yeah, that you explain that so well in your book. I'd love to talk a little bit about that, that the usual approach and the growing approach is to see it as they have it, like it's a disease. And you make the distinction that it's something they do. It's a behavioral pattern that occurs under certain circumstances. So say a parent gets a diagnosis of ADHD for, say, their 6-year-old. What is the usual approach today, Dr. Weiner?
So the usual approach is that usually physicians are involved, and they encourage the parent that if you give the youngster a stimulant, that the youngster will concentrate and finish more of their work and be less disruptive at home and in school and complete more of the required tasks that you give the youngster. And the other aspect, the psychological aspect, is that the youngster is viewed as unable to self-control, and therefore the parent has to supply the child with the control the child doesn't have. So the presumption that the child is unable to self-control because they have a control deficiency, it leads the parent to then do much more coercive socialization, which is introduce behavior charts and punishments and timeout chairs and reminders and directives, because it's thought that the child won't generate or learn to generate these things very well. So the whole presumption of a medical problem leads to medicines and then particular kinds of parenting. And the problem is that these kinds of interventions work quickly, because most a stimulant drug will get behavior change to occur rapidly. Most people, at least 80% of people, respond to a stimulant drug and they do more work and they focus better, and because they're focusing better, they're less disruptive and not doing other things. And most parents can easily institute a more coercive parenting, because it's a gun. It's always easier to dominate somebody than it is to develop a connected, collaborative relationship. A cooperative is a much more difficult problem for people to do. So the traditional ways of intervening give you ease of use, rapid results, but long term, we're finding that the youngsters who were medicated as a treatment, they don't really end up any different than the unmedicated kids, so there's no long-term benefit. And Consumer Reports has been clear about this, that beyond 2 years, there's no evidence that the medicines are really helping people. And then there's all sorts of side effects and complications when you socialize anyone under a coercive system. And the most apparent is the consequences of what happens when you institutionalize people, which is how well they learn to behave in the world under an institution. They learn all sorts of behaviors to deal with the fact that other people control their access to resources, and they don't do very well when the person who's in control is not available, because then the behaviors don't occur unless they're coerced. So that's one of the traditional model actually gets in the way of the child developing the very behaviors that would do them well in life, which is to become a self-reliant person who cooperates not under duress, but because they initiate cooperation and care for others. So that's what I've tried to do in terms of turning the treatment into a different direction.
Yeah, that certainly is a big difference. In the book, you talk about some of the reasons that we're assuming it is a biological problem, and one of them is that the stimulant medication does get the desired reaction pretty quick. But you make that in the book, you make the analogy with alcohol. If someone is very shy, you give them alcohol, they get less shy, but that doesn't mean they had a lack of alcohol or that they had a biological problem.
Yeah, the fact that alcohol helps a person become more sociable doesn't tell you why they weren't socializing. So it the treatment doesn't tell you the cause. So the medicines work for everybody in the same way. They'll get everybody to do better. And college kids are now taking these meds like in the old days it used to be Notos or some kind of caffeine. So it's not just a very sophisticated way to get a brain stimulate your brain.
Right. What about doctors who say, well, there's brain differences and different levels of stimulation in the brain, and what's your answer to that? I know you explained it in the book, but I want to share that with the listeners.
So people respond to brain research as if the differences in the brains must mean, well, if their brains have look different under these kinds of tests, then it must be that the brain, that kind of brain, is causing these behaviors. But people are not recognizing that the brain is like any other organ, that it changes and develops as a consequence of what the person does as they live in the world. So that if you're an athlete and you exercise, your heart and your muscles are very different from if you're sedentary. So the idea that if the child doing ADHD behaviors isn't solving many problems and isn't getting encouraged or reinforced to be more independent, their brain is going to show very different patterning and responses. And if the youngster is learning to avoid all sorts of schoolwork and other things, the brain will show what the way they live in the world. Like they show that if you drive a cab, they did a study for London cab drivers that the cab drivers had spatial cortex, which was getting developed because of the function of driving a cab all around the city. So that this brain data is only co-occurring data. It isn't cause. It's not demonstrating a cause. So the idea is if you change the way the ADHD kids are behaving, you're going to change the way the brain's responding.
I think that's so important because many in the popular culture, we tend to think, well, if it runs in families or it's associated with certain genes, then it must be biological. But that's not the case. These things are constantly interacting from even pregnancy and birth and how the family responds to the baby and so on. So I think it's such a wonderful point. And in the book, you talk about how people say, well, it does run in families and twins tend to be ADHD, both of them. How do you respond to that point that it's runs in the family, so it must be biological?
Okay, so this is critical, is that when people have had babies and raised kids, they know that each baby is different from the start. And some babies present different problems of socialization. If the baby's having trouble digesting food and very uncomfortable and crying, the parent's going to have to attend to the baby very differently than if the baby was more settled and comfortable. And the baby's opportunity to learn is also going to be affected because they're in pain and they're uncomfortable and they can't turn over and they can't use their muscles in the way that other babies might be using their muscles. So that if the baby's not coordinated physically as much, the parent has to help differently, and the baby, the toddler, starts to be more reliant on the parent. The parent may be fearful of falling and have to watch the baby differently, intervene differently. And if the baby's very active, the parent may spend so much time trying to block the baby from getting hurt, but then a lot of their interactions are based on stopping the baby, obstructing the baby, and then the baby just responds to what the parent's doing. So depending on the way the person is, they learn very differently depending on your body and what your biology changes the probability of what you're going to learn. If you're very tall, then you may be encouraged to play basketball and learn to play basketball, but you're not going to do that if you're very short, so you may do something different. So the idea that, of course, identical twins are more likely to both show ADHD because their bodies are similar, and also, like as we know with identical twins, their environments are often very similar as well. So what they learn is very likely to be the same kinds of outcomes.
Dr. Wiener, we're up on a break, our first break here. So please stay tuned. I want to now, when we come back, we'll move into reinforcement and how to change that. So we're speaking with Craig Wiener, who's written a wonderful book called Parenting Your Child with ADHD, A No-Nonsense Guide for Nurturing Self-Reliance and Cooperation, and a new, powerful new drug-free program. So stay tuned.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters. Whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance, Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RANDYROLFE.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back. We're talking about drug-free help for ADHD, and my guest is Dr. Craig B. Wiener, who's an education specialist and a psychologist, and well-known for his books for professionals on the field, but he has a new book that's for us, the rest of us, for the parents and teachers and counselors. It's called Parenting Your Child with ADHD, A No-Nonsense Guide for Nurturing Self-Reliance and Cooperation. And it's a very exciting book because it really takes the medical approach by the horns and says, you know, we can't give up on psychology. There's a lot going on in the environment of a child that reinforces ADHD behavior. And we've been talking about some of those differences in the first segment. So now I want to ask you, Dr. Wiener, to explain more about how ADHD in most cases is primarily a behavioral issue and how that gets reinforced. You did explain a little bit about how the coercive model creates behaviors in the parents that kind of actually reinforce these behaviors. So can we talk about that in a little more detail?
All right. So if the youngster's not doing ADHD when settled and interested and confident and competent in the activities associated with positive kinds of things, then an ADHD occurs under conditions of evaluation or assignment or restriction, or when youngsters are exposed to intrusions from the parent or unwanted transitions, then it's a behavior that has to do with how the youngster deals with adversity. And if the youngster can either learn to comply with and accommodate the adversity, or learn to do another kind of response to contend with, to cope with the adversity. Now, ADHD is simply a list of behaviors that have to do with either the youngsters being intrusive when we want them to limit themselves to boundaries, or they're being non-participatory when we want them to be participating. So if you, the idea is how does this youngster learn to contend when the parent is requiring or expecting one behavior and the youngster wants to do a different behavior? So it's an issue of who's going to accommodate to whom. The youngster can either be intrusive when the parent wants the youngster to abide by a restriction, or the youngster can learn to be non-participatory when the parent wants the child to be involved. So the ADHD behavior, which is, if there's some of the behaviors have to do with avoidance behaviors. So if the youngster does an avoidant behavior, then the youngster essentially screams out, like all avoidances, you protect yourself from the unwanted event. So the distractibility and non-attentiveness and failure to listen when spoken to are all behaviors that enable permit the child to screen themselves from unwanted requirements. And the so-called impulsive behaviors have to do with not abiding by the limit, or dealing with frustration, or being desperate behaviors to obtain what the child wants when the child has an obstacle. And so these are behaviors that, if the outcomes get the child where they want to go, then it's what I call reinforced. So I have the notion of, I just did it in terms of five different kinds of reinforcements. And one is, of course, attention. So that if hyperactive behaviors are often get others to be more attentive, because being loud and moving around usually gets others to have to redirect their actions towards the child. So hyperactivity and loudness is often gets reinforced through getting parents to be more responsive. You can't ignore these kinds of things. As youngsters often could be in jeopardy or anything else, the parents are going to have to respond. So the other reinforcement for ADHD is what I call accommodation, which is if the child's not doing their homework and not doing this and not doing that, and the parent comes over and says, well, we got to get this homework done, and starts to help the child and do it with the child, then there's a kind of where the child has learns that if they don't carry out their responsibility, somebody else takes over and does it for them or with them, or reduces the amount of what's expected, or then the youngster gets reinforced as well, because then not being responsible gets reinforced as other people begin to pick up the slack. And then one of the other reinforcements is what I call antagonism, which is that if a relationship is disrupted, then sometimes we want to strike back. And if the youngster learns to get the parent aggravated, and the reinforcement, just like anything else, if the youngster's angry, then getting somebody else angry is something that gets reinforced. Then if the parent feels sorry and badly about what they did, it's got an even greater benefit, because now the parent, it starts with the child aggravating the parent, and the parent's then feeling badly about what they did. Now the parent is more of a conforming to what the child wants. And then another reinforcement is acquisition. So a lot of these behaviors is getting what you want more quickly than before other people can stop you, and it's getting the results without waiting. So you go rushing, even if you knock people over, you may get to the line first, or you may get through the assignment more quickly, because it's a way to get to the end point faster and get what you want more quickly. And then, so those are the kinds of reinforcements that, if you look at all the different ADHD behaviors, you can see that they end up with outcomes that would actually get the behaviors to keep recurring when the similar situations happen again.
Right. So when the adult on the scene is frustrated or impatient or overreacts and yells and feels bad, all of these reinforce those behaviors, because the child is getting the attention they want or the accommodation they want. They get to avoid some undesirable behavior they don't want to participate in, or they, like you said, get to the front of the line. That's very powerful. And I love in the book, you call it that ADHD for, in many cases, is just a particular way to operate in the world. I thought that was a wonderful way to describe it, that this is a coping pattern that they fall into.
Yeah, so in some ways, if we start to see the behaviors in this in that light, then now as parents, we can have a profound influence, because we can change what happens in a way where these behaviors no longer have the great benefits, because these behaviors, like all the things we do in life, they have side effects. So that, yeah, the youngster's getting avoidance, but avoidance never helps you really learn or master anything. So the more the child's learning all these avoidance behaviors, they also not developing. And that's true for lots of different things. People who have anxieties are never not going to solve it as long as they're avoiding. So it's always going to have to be, how can the parent restructure the child's world so that it makes it safe and reasonable for the child to begin to do the things that they've already learned to avoid?
Yeah, that's very powerful. So let's talk about some of the changes that a parent can work on to stop these reinforcements. And I think that can be very scary, because they think, well, the child's just going to keep screaming until I give in the way I always do, or they're going to be even more difficult in school if I change the way I deal with it, because I've been told to keep the limits tight and to respond a certain way. So you talk about first identifying the triggers that create in that particular child the ADHD reactions. I know you have a lot of good tools in the book to do that, but can you tell a little more about what kind of triggers a parent can look for?
So the idea is to start to watch your child's behavior and see under what conditions they're likely to do certain kinds of things. So if you bring them in a room and you start talking to your friend, or the phone rings and they all of a sudden they start doing things that they know are going to pull you away from the phone call, it means that they're having trouble with that you're involved with somebody else. And why is it that how can you then deal with that situation in a different way? So now what if you talk to the youngster ahead of time, if you say, well, I'm going to be on the phone, what would you like to be doing while I'm on the phone? Or how do you feel if I'm on the phone for right now? Will this work out for you? Or if not, it's coordinating with the child in a way that you're working with the child, rather than if you act out while I'm on the phone, I'm going to put you, when I get out of the phone call, I'm going to put you in a chair. So your relationship is going to be just a big struggle. And then the youngster is going to deal with wanting to get back at you because you just did something to them. So it's a way to pattern a parent and a child in such that their relationship stays connected and coordinated. And if you want to start to deal with when is your child doing these behaviors, ADHD, like if they're rushing and to get to finish quickly, well, why? Or if they're rushing to the line, are they afraid they'll be left out? So you want to talk with the child about what's their concern? If they don't get to the front, no one will notice them, or they'll be left out. So once you've solved the problem of what the youngster's trying to solve, what's the problem for the child, then you can deal with what do you do as a solution to help the child learn what's an alternative behavior, or how can we make sure the child feels differently so that the child isn't so anxious about missing out or getting exposed. Yeah.
Right. I think that's such an interesting point that, and it's one of the downsides of the biological approach, I think, because once a parent thinks, oh, well, this child has a deficit or deficiency or disability, then they figure they just have to control the child. They're not even going to explain as much as they would to a regular child, or normal or whatever. Because they think they just have to say, look, you're going to sit here for 5 minutes, instead of saying, I need you to be quiet while I talk to the doctor on the phone. So it's almost like a vicious circle that they're less, they coordinate less with the child than they would with someone who they assumed had normal abilities. Is that right?
That's a very interesting point, is that the presumption of disability gets the parent to even be less attentive to the child's perspective, thinking that the parent has to impose more. So that it's, boy, what a vicious cycle gets created at that point. And it's, yeah.
Right. It's a hard conundrum to get out of, and I think you've done a great job helping parents. You described 10 principles that they need to focus on, and I'm sure we can't cover all 10, but can we, well, one, you were just mentioning that it's okay to explain to the person why you need the child to sit there while you're on the phone, or why you need them to finish their meal so you can go visit grandma. So you have that as one of the principles is patience. Can you expound on some of those principles, if you would, Dr. Wiener?
Yeah, and some of them I think are very consistent with your 7 secrets.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I think that we're really just operating in the same way, is that the first principle is use coercion as a last resort. So none of this means that you're not going to perhaps end up taking a child's bike if you can't solve the problem of the helmet or the danger or something. Or if you want quick results, you can always coerce. But it means it's the last resort. It's because it has all the side effects, coercion, like we were talking about before. And the staying calm is, a lot of people are talking about ADHD now as a problem to emotionally regulate, a failure to regulate emotions, but that has to, how it may be that some babies are more volatile and extreme in their emotional responses, but a lot can happen in development to calm these babies down. But if your youngster is already overreacting, then there's a parenting that you can do to help create calmness. And one of it, of course, is for the parent to have a calm style and for the parent to make sure that they don't escalate with the child, because it's just teaching the child to escalate. And the way to, if a parent to help the child see that if we're calm, we can solve it better, and just kind of wait to see if you get the child to calm down and talk then, not that you give in when a child's screaming, because then you just reinforce screaming. So if these ADHD kids are emotionally extreme, then one of the important components of any treatment is going to be to calm that down. And how do you get the youngster to see the world in a less extreme way? You never do this for me. You always do that. You mean sometimes this happens, or maybe this time it'll be this way, but next time it'll be that way, or I can hear you much better if we talk a little softer so we can think better together. It's like a redirecting in a very calm, subtle way to have the youngster work with you. It's not a control issue. It's all about establishing a relationship rather than establishing control. The other thing
So important. It reminds me, we're coming up on a break, but it reminds me of a story with my 18-year-old son. He was going out, and sometimes he would stay out with friends overnight, and sometimes he'd come home late. And he said he just didn't want to say which it was going to be. And so he had that problem of whether I was trying to control him, but I was actually just trying to protect my home. I didn't want to wake up in the middle of the night wondering who's at the door. So I said, you know, tell me if you might stay out all night. I would require the same thing of a 50-year-old guest. And all of a sudden he's like, oh, that makes perfect sense. I thought you were trying to control me as a kid. So being clear about why you're doing things is so critical. So your book reminded me of that when you talked about teaching the child self-care, and so they understand you're not trying to make them do what you want. You're trying to be a good parent and protect them where they needed protection.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
So we're coming back after the break, and we're going to share more with Dr. Craig Wiener, Parenting Your Child with ADHD from a Non-Drug Psychological Approach Rather Than a Biological Disability. So stay tuned.
Learn more
Live better. Voice America Health and Wellness.
What if thinking just a little bit differently about your daughter could make her more respectful, a better student, or less vulnerable to peer pressure? What if a few simple changes in your words with your son could make him more responsible, a better listener, or more fun? Five-time author and dynamic speaker Randy Rolfe has answers to your questions about family matters. Whether it's your kids, parents, schools, health and diet issues, finances, or life balance, Randy can help you. The World Ambassador for Family, Randy Rolfe has been helping families since 1985 to minimize the stress and heartache of modern living. To access some great and free downloadable tools, to get one of her internationally acclaimed books, or to have her inspire and excite your next event as your featured speaker, go to www.randyrolfe.com. That's RandyRolfe.com. Your family will thank you.
Hi, I'm Neil Haley, host of the Total Education Network. We're the only education talk show that airs shows 7 days a week on different stations. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org to learn about the exciting shows coming to the network. The show brings the total education experience. We interview interesting guests, have lively debates, and provide news and provide tips for parents. Please go to my website at TotalTutor.org for more information. Remember, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators, TotalTutor.org.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're tuned in to Family First with your host, Randy Rolfe. To speak to Randy or her guests, please call 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to randyrolfe@randyrolfe.com. Now, back to Family First.
Welcome back, and thank you for being part of the Family First family. We have over 50,000 people listening every month to our show, and that's because we have fabulous guests every week, like Greg Wiener today, speaking about drug-free help for ADHD. We've been talking about taking a psychological approach and a behavioral approach rather than a medical or and drug-mediated approach, and we've been discussing how certain patterns that develop in the home unconsciously and not on purpose can actually reinforce the ADHD behaviors. So now we've been talking in the last segment about ways that parents can pull away from those reinforcing behaviors that where there's a payoff for the child to act out. And most parents know that their ADHD child doesn't always climb the walls and yell and scream. It's just in certain times of conflict and adversity. So let's talk, Dr. Wiener, about some more of the principles that parents can keep in mind. First was just using coercion as a last resort. And my first career was as an attorney. And I realized that going to court is the last thing before you come to fisticuffs. And in parenting, you want to start way back in a different place where there's trust and coordination and cooperation and communication. So I love that you start with that, you know, use it. It's a last resort. If they're stepping in front of a car, you better well just yank them back.
Yep.
But there's a whole lot of steps before you have to do that in most cases.
Yeah, the hope is that most of life you can coordinate in a way where it's cooperative rather than dominance and submission. So I think it leads to much more connected relationships and a much more willingness of the child to respond to the parent. So you won't get this kind of delayed reaction all the time. It's almost as if the youngster associates the parent or the teacher or any adult with restriction or criticism or disapproval, something adverse rather than something to approach and to join in with. It's really to keep connection in relationships.
So true. I love the concept you said of redirecting that you can give the child a different way to look at a situation. If it's really stimulating bad behavior, unwanted behavior, then you can redirect them, have them understand how it's actually in their interest. And one of the principles you talk about is to address problems rather than just hope the child calms down and it goes away. You need to address problems and communicate. Can you talk more about that? I think it's so vital.
Yes, I think that's important. That often parents may respond initially to less coercive methods, as if we're letting the child get away with something. We're not doing all we can to socialize the child or to help the child. And I don't want the notion of less coercion doesn't mean that the parent is less active. You're very active, even if it means you might not respond to certain behaviors, because ultimately that may be the best way to train them out. The quickest way to get rid of them is maybe sometimes not to respond. But the parent often would make sure that you're addressing problems that are interfering with your rapport and the family life and what's getting in the way. So if parents say, gee, I haven't been getting enough time on the computer, let's figure out a way to take turns rather than just suffer and be kind of resentful that the child is dominating the activities and not learning to share. So it's always addressing things. It's not avoiding problems when they occur. And I thought it was similar to your secret of I speak my mind and I know when to stop, which is it's a relationship, so it's two ways. It's not child-dominated or parent-dominated, and it's knowing when to stop is the lecturing and the intrusive parent will not get the relationship to be as intimate and connected as the mutual exchange and the volley and the buy-in where both of you are comfortable with the results. And the youngster in the process learns how to problem solve and how to accommodate and compromise. And the brain will develop differently as the child is stimulated in these ways.
That's so powerful. Thank you. I think that it's wonderful for parents to treat children like people. They need to be communicated with, not at. That's so true. And another principle is not passing judgment. And I think that relates to what I talk about having faith in the child. It's not that, okay, they slap this disability on them and now, okay, I'm not going to pay attention to this problem because he's just acting out. You don't judge the child. You rather work with him to solve problems. Is that right?
Yes. Under the idea that I would never give up on my child, that secret is the treating a child as competent to succeed. And when you deal with somebody as competent, you talk in a particular way, and the youngster gets reinforced about their acceptance and adequacy. And it develops those behaviors rather than treating the child as incompetent. And it's almost as if that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the idea of respecting that the child nods or agrees and buys into the solution is a respect to the child's point of view. So you're developing empathy and the notion of respect. And the idea is that by approaching the child in this way, the child learns and copies you and does the same for you and others. And then when they go off and marry somebody or function as an employee, they're going to now be equipped to do all these wonderful behaviors that we know will make them succeed.
Yeah, it's really preparing them for life. And you also have some wonderful exercises and examples in your book, which we obviously can't possibly share. But you talk about staying positive, speaking in a positive tone instead of accusing or complaining or criticizing. Can you give some examples of that?
Yeah, so most of what we say can be reworded in the positive rather than you can't have a snack right now. You could say we're eating real soon. Let's save our appetites so we can eat together. Or it's a way for the child to be directed towards the advantage rather than the limit or the deprivation. So the negative statements just get the child focused on how they're being deprived or rather than what the advantage of doing it differently is. And that's what the what wonderful things will happen if we do it in a different way. And the notion of speaking without judgment helps the child open up and share thoughts and feelings rather than be afraid that they're going to not be accepted by the other person because they don't meet the other person's views of what's possible. So the youngster ends up closing down and not sharing their life. And most parents would love the idea that the child is comfortable enough to come to them when they're having trouble or something happened that went wrong, that went the way they didn't like it, and you could then you're available to actually help the child. Once the child gets secretive and afraid, you're not going to be able to help the child because you're not going to be sharing your life together. And that's part of it. It's really a way to keep your intimacy. And intimacy and connectedness is going to be the antidote to the ADHD behaviors.
That's beautiful. Speaking of talking positively made me think of what if the parent says, well, I'll create a positive thing. If you're good in the store, I'll give you some candy. Can you comment on the reward-punishment approach?
All right, so if you're good, I'll give you candy, then the notion that the candy is somehow more important than the good is just instrumental to get the candy. But I want to make it so that once you do that, then your youngster stops responding to cooperating as an end in itself. And in some ways, why do that? Because the joy of this, of each other and smiling and caring for each other, that's the greatest joy around. And in some ways, I want to keep the child directed that if we cooperate in the store together, we'll have fun, or we'll get our shopping done. It will be nice. We'll have food tonight, and we'll probably be done faster together. And so that then the youngster's going to say, if I give you candy, he says, I want two candies, or else I'm not going to be good. So then you get into a contract thing where I want more money, and you got to give me. So you're ending up fighting with each other about how little I'm going to give you and how much you're going to want. And then the youngster's going to deal with, well, what happens if I don't give you candy? Then now there's no reason to cooperate. I have to give you candy every time. It's a diminishment of the relationship, which is silly for us to do with each other.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. It isn't a business relationship. I used to say to the kids, they're fully grown now, but I used to say, you know, virtue is its own reward. And they'd say, well, my friend gets, you know, a lollipop every time he goes to the bank. And I'm like, you know, being good feels good. That's all you need.
That's
and you just
need
to know that.
Yes.
And you feel good, you sleep well at night. And they caught on pretty quickly. But, you know, when they challenge you, like, well, my friend gets a reward for taking care of keeping his room neat. And you say, well, you know, keeping your room neat has its own rewards. So let's focus on them.
Well, I say to the youngster that we buy candy anyway. It's not based on whether you're good. It's the candy is something we have for each other in limited amounts to be healthy, whatever your parent says. But it's not something that's tied to doing some expectation, because you're going to run into. Think about all the people that are socialized in prisons and institutions and what they learn to deal with the people who control their world, and all the side effects that go with those behaviors, and how poorly the people function when they leave the institution. And those are the same side effects and limitations your youngster will have if your family socializes like an institution.
So true. We just have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to talk a little bit about how a parent, even if they work with these principles and they see changes at home and the ADHD behavior is not as coming up as often, how can they... just quickly, how can they help their children deal with situations where they're not there, like when they're in school and a child is saying, oh, you're dumb or you're disruptive, or even a teacher saying that you're disrupting the class, you have to go sit in the corner. How can a parent, how does the parent's influence help with when the child's in the school situation?
So the first thing is the behaviors we're doing at home will generalize better to school, because the youngster's going to learn to accommodate to others better under these new conditions. If the youngster talks about having problems at school, then the idea is to work the youngster through the problems at school, because the youngster is going to enjoy school more if they behave in a certain way. It's not that they have to do well in school or they're going to be punished or something terrible will happen to them. It's that they will like it better. They will learn more, and you make school to be, knowing things is a value, and you pay attention to what the child's mastery and what they learn, and you make being a student a privileged status, I call it. And that when you're a serious student and the family does all kinds of things to help subsidize and make that possible, because that's a very special status to be a student. And you want to help the child see schoolwork in the same way they would learn a Nintendo game or building blocks or Legos. It's just another thing to do that can be fun and interesting and nice. It's only when it becomes associated with, even if you tell a kid you have to eat this ice cream cone, you're going to spoil the ice cream cone if you make it something that has to. So the problem for parents is how to make learning in school something that the child sees as a opportunity, not a restriction or a terrible thing. So
that makes so much sense. Even like that's a great example of the ice cream cone. If you say, "Well, don't let it drip, and you better hurry up," and before you know it, it's no fun at all.
Yeah.
Well, we just have a moment left. I want our listeners to know about your book, Parenting Your Child with ADHD, and your website has a wonderful, I accessed your PowerPoint. That was delightful. And your book's available everywhere now, I assume, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. And what is your website, Dr. Wiener?
It's www.craigwiener.com. And my name is spelled W-I-E-N-E-R. And so if you just click on that, you can see how to order the book and some different information about ADHD in the sense of the way we're talking today.
Yeah, and I certainly hope it gets a lot of attention from the public, as just like the professionals are paying attention to a more psychological approach, because it is a serious problem. Almost 10% of our population are getting this diagnosis, and it can be very misunderstood. So thank you so much for being a guest on Family First, Dr. Wiener.
Well, thank you so much for having me and giving me this opportunity.
You're welcome. So have happy holidays and take care.
Yeah, take care.
We hope you've enjoyed Family First. Please tune in to our program every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time, to join your host, Randy Rolfe, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. The weekend is here. Enjoy it with your family. And we hope to see you here next week.